The Tom Woods Show, episode 1433.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, the school year is winding down as I record this, and it's soon going to be time to think about next year's homeschool curriculum. Well, how about getting your mental health back and not running yourself ragged as a homeschooling parent anymore by using the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum? Your children will get a top-notch education in all the standard subjects, plus they'll learn how to start their own home business, how to be an effective public speaker, how to manage their money, the kind of topics that don't get taught anywhere. Plus, get $160 worth of free bonuses when you subscribe to the curriculum through ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Oh, man, this conversation is by sheer necessity. It's got to be done. I wish we didn't have to have this conversation, but we do. Apparently, there's been some kind of exchange between the chairman of the Libertarian National Committee, Nick Sarwark, and the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. We're going to get to the bottom of it. But it culminated in the insinuation that of all things, that I swear to you this happened. I swear it happened. That the Ron Paul 2008 presidential campaign was bankrolled or in some way influenced by the Russian government. Now, that's one I have not heard from anyone. I mean, I know people lose their minds when they talk about Russia. And there's a lot of insanity surrounding Russia. But this is a first. This one is brand new to me. And it turns out that the evidence for this does not exist. The chairman of the party linked to an article, we're going to talk about this in a minute, linked to an article that purports to demonstrate this. And it has to be the dumbest thing I've ever seen. So dumb that I want you to read it. I mean, if it were really making arguments against us, I would maybe hope people wouldn't find it. No. To the contrary, I hope you do read it. I hope you click on tomwoods.com/1433 and you find this thing and you read it. And you realize that the head of a, if not major, then certainly an important minor political party actually linked to this, thinking it bolstered his case. I mean, this is serious derangement. Well, joining me to talk about the derangement is our old friend Daniel McAdams, who is executive director of the Ron Paul Institute. And we have not spoken in some time, and I could not be more delighted to have him back. Daniel, welcome back.
Hey, Tom, it's so great to be back on your show.
I don't even know what to say to you in this situation. I mean, I really, really, really and truly and honestly do not want to talk about this guy. I have gone out of my way to just ignore him. And the main reason, even though he's been, you know, pretty unkind to me. It's funny. The other day, he retweeted Mike Gravel, who was saying "end all the wars," and Sarwark is jumping on board, saying, "Well, I support that." Well, I say that 24 hours a day, and he never thinks to retweet me because I do only wrong. Okay, everything I do is wrong, so I'm only to be cited when I'm at my wrongest. Whereas Mike Gravel, who's horrible on pretty much everything, but good on war, gets the retweet. I mean, who cares? The reason I don't bother with him is that when he stops being the chairman of the Libertarian National Committee, no one's going to care about him. No one is going to say, "I wonder what Nick Sarwark thinks about whatever." I mean, it's like saying, "I wonder, is anybody in 2019 saying, well, you know what, before we come to a conclusion about this, let's find out what Gary Johnson thinks." I mean, he's a non-entity. He's forgotten about. Nobody cares. And so it would be ridiculous overkill for me to be addressing this person at all. Plus, he digs his own grave because every time he attacks somebody like me, he gets ratioed. He gets 500 comments, that 498 of which are against him. I mean, at some point, he's got to say, "This ain't working," right? I mean, this is just not working. But anyway, you're the most recent victim, if we may put it that way, you and the Ron Paul Institute. And I want to start off with what it was that initially provoked him. I guess on your site, there was a post relating to Sarwark and the issue of regime change in Venezuela. So let's talk about that just broadly as an issue before we get into the Sarwark aspect of it, because it's at least understandable why somebody would look at Venezuela and think, well, how much worse could it get? I mean, even a CIA-led coup has got to be better than what they're living with now. So what's your position on that?
If that was ever the case, it might be worth considering, but there's never been a case where a revolution like that has ever produced a better result. And if there is, I'd be happy to see it. You can go all the way back to the prototype, the People Power Revolution in the Philippines back in the 80s. They got rid of the shoe lady, but did their lives get any better? You know, and I believe, and Dr. Paul believes, and I believe you probably share that view, that a libertarian revolution, a pro-market revolution, that is more of an evolution than a revolution. That's something that comes when the hearts and minds of the people are changed. And unfortunately, that's a long, slow slog, as we know, those of us who dedicate our lives to it here in the U.S., which is far more ripe than other countries for a libertarian-style government. It's a long, slow slog. The idea that you can flip a switch and have a libertarian society is basically just fantasy land.
Right. So, all right. So tell me about exactly what happened now. What was the problem? Did Sarwark retweet a video, or just give me the details on that?
The trigger, you mean? He was triggered.
Yeah, maybe.
He sent out a, quote, "Dear Libertarian" letter under the letterhead of the Libertarian Party. And it had a video embedded in it by a Dr. Varner, who is an American, who claims that he learned Spanish by watching Hugo Chavez videos. And as he was watching these videos learning Spanish, he realized what a monster Hugo Chavez was and had to dedicate himself to overthrowing the Maduro regime, which is aligned ideologically with the Chavez leftist revolution. A pretty strange story, if you ask me, in and of itself.
Yeah.
However, the Sarwark part that comes in is he shared the video of this fellow speaking Spanish and essentially calling for regime change. And I'll give you the operative line. And not just regime change. You must support the person that the U.S. government, the CIA, that Mike Pence, that John Bolton supports to be president. He said, "Those who do not recognize Juan Guaido, they are the real enemies. Not only of the Venezuelan people, but also of all of us libertarians." And that is pretty clear, a pretty clear statement. So Adam Dick, who's a senior fellow at the Ron Paul Institute, wrote it up and said that Nick Sarwark, the chairman of the Libertarian Party, is sharing a video promoting regime change with a specific candidate in Venezuela. And that doesn't sound very libertarian, in fact. And of course, the irony, and I guess we can get into this later, but the irony, of course, now is that Guaido is in deep doo-doo because it's turned out that his entire revolution in April was a complete scam and millions of dollars have been stolen by his top party henchmen.
Oh, I actually didn't know about this development.
Oh, yes, it's absolutely. It broke in a, interestingly enough and appropriately enough, it broke in an anti-Maduro newspaper out of Miami. Called the Pan Am Post, and it details the trickery, the theft, the mishandling of hundreds of tons of aid, which have now had to been broken, and the extraordinarily shoddy treatment of those soldiers, those few soldiers that they were able to coax into defecting. It's really a story. We have it on the Ron Paul Institute website, but it's really an amazing story. These people absconded with possibly millions of dollars. So Guaido's name is mud now, which just shows you, Tom, why we shouldn't go picking people to rule other countries overseas, because we really don't know anything about them.
Right, right. But yet there is still isn't there still a nagging voice? Now, I mean, a lot of these people who write commentaries like this are what I call CIA libertarians, you know, State Department libertarians. You know, we know these people. These are the people who, you know, their attention is always on whatever the villain of the day happens to be in the State Department. You know, so they take their agenda and their marching orders from the State Department. Or also they're like, I don't want to mention any names, but I could just think of one particular loser in the DC orbit who would go to Iraq and walk around handing out U.S. constitutions. I mean, could you imagine anything as foolish and idiotic as that?
He made a good living with it.
yeah, and no doubt. And got to travel the world and, let's say, meet a lot of interesting people. Leave it at that.
A lot of friends. A lot of good friends.
Yeah, made a lot of good friends while doing that. Anyway, so, all right, so now you've got a bit of a problem. At least you've got a conflict with Sarwark. So he hits back at you guys and says what?
Well, he hits back hard and he starts retweeting things. And the operative one is where he tweets something suggesting, of course, he doesn't have the courage to name names, but it's about how terrible it is that some people who call themselves libertarians are actually support the governments of Venezuela and China and Russia. You know, it's a sort of a weaselly word, hit back. And, you know, it's the old thing, Tom, and you remember it well. It happened in the Iraq War. It happened with Libya. It happens all the time. If you don't support the CIA view of what should happen in a country, well, you just happen to be in love with that leader. Oh, you don't want to overthrow Saddam? How much is he paying you? And that's kind of the mentality of the strike back.
So one of these responses from him included a link that I think in 1,433 episodes of this show, I can safely say is the dumbest thing that has been linked to related to any of the topics I've covered. I mean, it's that bad. In fact, I want people to see the article Sarwark linked to because you think, all right, well, look, maybe Woods has a beef with Sarwark and who's to say who's right or wrong? Okay. All right, fine. I mean, as I say, I'm the one who's I have never started anything with that guy. Never, ever did I start. You can look at – we have the entire paper trail of every interaction he and I have had. I have not started one of them. But this piece that he links to on Medium.com is so shockingly bad. Even though it's an attack on you guys, Daniel, I want people to read it because it's so unbelievably bad. It's a piece by some guy. I mean, basically – the guy is of no standing whatsoever. He's some guy who claims that he used to be a Ron Paul supporter. We got a bunch of those,
yeah.
Right? Who go online and then they beat their breast. Oh, my progressive friends, will you ever forgive me? My intentions were pure, and how was I to know? And all that. So, what? Tell me about this article.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, this is right up there with the protocols of Zion in terms of its crazy conspiratorial nature. But this guy, who we don't really know who his real name even is. Who now renounces his tipping his toes into the ideological waters of libertarianism and has renounced libertarianism as an evil philosophy. He wrote an article saying he was sitting there one day thinking about Donald Trump and Ron Paul, and he realized that they had a lot in common. Their campaigns had a lot in common. And so therefore, because Trump is obviously Putin's puppet, of course, I think that was a pre-Mueller conclusion that, aha, now I get it. The dots are being connected. And here is his evidence. Both campaigns had an insurgent candidate with views that fell squarely outside the traditional GOP standards. Well, imagine that. You know, they rested their argument on the failed nature of the U.S. government as a continuing experiment. They were labeled populists. They were speaking of the need to rid Washington of the elites. And they possessed an absolutely rabid support base.
And no, by the way, every single one of those is true of Bernie Sanders. Every last one.
Exactly. And if anyone, at least as a campaigner, look at Obama. He positioned himself pretty much in that position.
Yep.
So that's kind of how you win elections. So this article goes on. I agree. It's definitely worth reading this. But he goes on to talk about how, Rand took a trip to Russia a while ago, if you remember, trying to establish dialogue really in the spirit of the president's campaign. And that was, of course, evidence that the Russians were behind Ron Paul.
But behind his 2008 campaign.
2008.
So they were already planning this before Rand was even in the Senate.
And he said there is no smoking gun, but it still bothers him. And here are the things. Ron Paul met Václav Klaus. Wow. Smoking gun.
Okay. Yeah. Half the libertarian world has met Václav Klaus.
One of the great libertarian thinkers of all time, you know, single-handedly, despite what they say about what really happened in Czechoslovakia, it was Klaus who was the intellectual behind the change of regime. I write frequently for Russia Today and Russia Insider, which of course I don't. If RT or Russia Insider or anyone else picks up anything written in the Ron Paul Institute, that's fair game because we have a policy. Anyone can publish anything anyone can republish anything we do. So when they're in there, a few other intriguing but more tenuous ties.
Wait. More tenuous even than these non-existent ties, in other words?
Yes, exactly. And the fact that John Laughlin, who I've worked with and known for – 25 years or so. He's an Oxford. He's a PhD from Sorbonne. He's an Oxford intellectual professor at the Sorbonne. He was one of the leaders of the British Helsinki group, and I've worked with him overseas for a number of years. Is a well-respected historian who's written like 5 or 6 books, and who sits on the board of the Ron Paul Institute because he's an extraordinarily interesting and intelligent person. Because I have him on, and he worked for a think tank that was tied to Russians, there is the smoking gun that Putin backed Ron Paul in 2008.
Are you kidding me?
This is it.
This is, yeah, so we'll latch on to what at that time was, at least the beginning, a very obscure candidate who, with the entire media against him. Now, that sounds like a good plan. Obviously, the better plan is to find who the plausible nominees are and try to worm your way in or make contacts with them. But why would you latch on to a candidate who, in 2008 at least, had an extremely uphill battle ahead of him? Yeah. It doesn't even make any sense. Why would you do it?
And if he actually started making momentum, he'd probably back out.
Yeah.
That's the last thing he wanted.
Yeah.
And it's also, I mean, more seriously, it's the idea that the Russians bankrolled Ron Paul is an insult to all of those people. And I'll tell you, you know this too, Tom. There was a lot of people who didn't have a lot of money, and they put money on their credit cards. They scraped together a couple of pennies, a couple of bucks, and they donated it because they believed what Ron Paul was talking about. A free market economy, a more sensible foreign policy. It's an insult to every single one of these people to suggest that they weren't part of the revolution. It was all some amazing plan concocted by Putin, who spotted Ron Paul as a potential dupe. It is just disgusting.
So that's an article now. So with no evidence whatsoever. I like how they say, well, now we've got some more things that are maybe a little bit more tenuous. The things you've already shown us don't even qualify as tenuous. It's nothing. It is entirely nothing. So then let's say a little something then about Russia. What is the Ron Paul Institute's opinion about what the United States policy toward Russia should be?
I think it should. I think the Ron Paul Institute's opinions, it should be like our policy toward every other country, which is what our founders suggested. You know, free trade and friendship with all nations who seek the same, and that's what got President Trump elected. You know, that's we're tired of this. He said, well, what's so bad about getting along with Russia? Is what Trump said. Of course, the Russians paid him to say that.
Right.
But what's so wrong with getting along with? You know, fill in the blank. Really, that's the question. If especially as a libertarian, what's so wrong with getting along with fill in the blank? Not trying to tell them how they should be governed, who should govern them, when they should bathe, you know, how they should brush their teeth. Just get along. Have commercial ties, have personal ties, educational ties among private citizens. And that's it. No entangling alliances. And that sounds like a pretty good idea. And that's our policy toward every country.
People will say that you're turning a blind eye to some, let's say, unacceptable Russian policy, and you're glorifying or whitewashing the leadership.
Yeah, but what policy would that be? What have they done? I mean, we had productive ties with Russia in the depths of the Cold War when they were pointing thousands of missiles at us, banging their shoes on the table and threatening to nuke us. Nevertheless, we'll go over there. We'll talk to them. Nixon met Brezhnev, and et cetera, et cetera. So how could it be worse with communism ended in Russia, with Russia actually, well, with the U.S. going around the world slapping sanctions, Russia's going around the world doing business. In a Russia like this, how could this be worse than under Stalin, you know, or Khrushchev? You know, it's this mindset that somewhere it's even worse than the Cold War. I don't know where it comes from other than the neocons in the military-industrial complex who thrive and who must have an enemy to survive.
The Russia hysteria, not just surrounding Trump, but just in general about Russia as a threat. I mean, you remember Mitt Romney famously said in one of the debates with Obama that Russia is our number one enemy, and everybody laughed at him at the time. And now it's chic among progressives to say, oh, Mitt Romney, we're so sorry. You were so right when you said that about the Russians. But it makes me wonder, is this what conservatives sounded like during the Cold War, maybe? I mean, I don't know. Is this like when left liberals would listen to conservatives, they must have rolled their eyes or something during the Cold War because that's probably what conservatives sounded like to them. I don't know. But this is – it doesn't correspond to anything. I mean, yeah, all right, I wouldn't necessarily want to live under the Russian regime. I mean, who cares? There's almost no regime I would want to live under in the world,
right? I don't
want
to live under our regime, please.
Yeah, I don't want to live under our regime, but these are the cards we've been dealt.
I mean, as I tweeted the other day, I'm all for getting rid of socialism. Can we please start here first?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's not like we don't have our hands full with stuff to do here. And it's just such a strange thing. I wish libertarianism well all over the world. I absolutely do. And I want people to be as free as possible. But at the same time, I've got limited resources and our movement has limited resources. And it just seems like the example I like very much comes from Jeff Deist when about a month and a half ago, we were at the state convention of the Libertarian Party of Florida. Jeff gave, as usual, a brilliant talk. And he gave the example. He was talking about a mass shooting that had occurred in Paris. And he said, now, I know that a lot of Americans and a lot of libertarians want to say, look, if the Parisians were open carrying, this wouldn't have been an issue. You know, they would have gotten that gunman and we wouldn't have had this problem. And he says, now, on the basis of the pure logic of it, there's no getting around that. That is true. That's absolutely true. He says, but the thing is, that's just not French. That's not the way the French think.
Yeah.
That's just not the way they think. So like that or not, that's a reality. You like that or not, that's a reality. So the question then becomes, given the limited resources we have and our limited scope and the huge array of problems we face at home, what kind of a use of resources would it be for us to try to turn Parisians into Texans on the gun issue?
Yeah.
You know, why not just be willing to say there are going to be a lot of parts of the world where there are a lot of things I object to, but there's just nothing I can do about that. I have to be reasonable. I have to be a non-utopian, and I have to focus my energies where I'm likely to get the most bang for the buck, namely right here.
Yeah, and there's a real danger. I mean, I think Jeff is, of course, absolutely right. There are cultural differences in the world, and to ignore those is to really be like a Stalin, to be like a Lenin. We will, if by force, if necessary, create the new Soviet man, whatever we have to do.
Yeah, it's a neo-colonialist mentality.
It is, and it's a Trotskyite mentality that we have to have a world permanent revolution. Countries may not be right. Maybe in 30 years, if they have a few more shootings, the people in France might change their mind and say, hey, you know what, let's try some guns. This might make things better. But for us to go over there and yell at them, you've got to try some guns, it doesn't work that way. And I think the Venezuela example is the perfect example. Hey, if you don't love Juan Guaido, you are an anti-libertarian. You hate the Venezuelan people. Well, it turns out the guy's a huge crook. So this is the point, and it goes along with your with your limited resources point. We don't have the ability, we don't have the knowledge to understand the complexities of a foreign society. Even this guy who goes over there watching Hugo Chavez speeches, he's got a lot of buddies in Venezuela, he knows all about it. And let me tell you, buddy, you better back this guy. Well, the guy's a crook. We just simply can't know. We can't even know in our own voting system, Tom, where we have access to so much more information about candidates. We can't even know the truth. Pardon me. Obama ran as a peace candidate. He snookered a lot of people. George W. Bush ran as no nation building. He snookered a lot of people. So we can't even know with our own candidates. How on earth are we going to pick and choose people overseas? It just really underscores the folly of this branch of libertarianism that thinks it needs to spread itself by hook or by crook overseas. I would say, and Dr. Paul always says, why don't we lead by example and fix this country and make it a beacon so people will want to emulate us?
Indeed. It's the Ron Paul message from all these years. Now, I want to address something that came up in just a social media thread, but your involvement in this British Helsinki group. There was somebody saying that this was a Putin front or whatever, even though it disbanded before Putin took power. I mean, these people are so pathetic. But tell me about this and what it was all about and why it's not what they say.
Yeah, it's a brilliant organization. It was started by Christine Stone, who is the wife of, sadly departed this week, Professor Norman Stone, as you know, the great 20th century conservative historian, who I think is really one of the most important intellectuals of the last 100 years and an absolute delight. Tom, I once spent an evening with Professor Stone and John Lukacs in an apartment. So Tom, yes, as a historian, I'm sure you can imagine what it was like being in that room. But Christine Stone was an attorney, and she was the wife of Oxford professor Norman Stone, and she started a group essentially. So let me back up just a little bit, Tom. All of the Helsinki groups that are praised by everyone, including libertarians, they say, oh, the British Helsinki was not a real Helsinki group. Well, the problem is that all of the quote-unquote real Helsinki groups are 100% funded by governments, right? So if your government funds your NGO and your NGO is a watchdog over your government, how objective are you going to be, right? And so that's the idea. The British Helsinki group was a free market alternative. We were funded by private – I would say they were funded by private donations. It was a private organization to counter all of these government-controlled Helsinki groups. And yes, we did take a contrarian view of many of the events that were happening at the time in the post-Soviet world. But yes, again, 20 years later, it turns out that the analysis that we did was right. The things that we were saying that were right. We were observing the very early stages of the color revolutions in places like Slovakia and places like Serbia and elsewhere. We were observing the practice runs for what came later in places like Libya. So in fact, we were right to challenge the state narrative that was being pushed by the other Helsinki groups. So if I mean, the idea that you would trash, as a libertarian, you would trash a private free market alternative to state funded NGOs, frankly, it's beyond me, Tom.
Yeah, no kidding. And well, and your experience in this area goes back, what, 20 plus years?
Yeah, it was. In fact, I finished up grad school and I moved to Hungary in 1993. And I wanted to observe, I was doing my master's in international relations, dealing with the then newly post-Soviet Central and Eastern Europe. And so my great friend at the State Department, where I was an intern as a grad student, I said, hey, go east. If you want to understand what's going on, get your feet on the ground. Don't read books. And so I moved there and I wanted to see on the ground what was happening. And so with the British Helsinki Group, we were able to go to these places. We were able to go to the hotspots. I spent a lot of time in Albania. If you remember, there was a revolution there in 96, which was one of the early people power revolutions. And, you know, there are books that could be written about that. But being on the ground there, observing it up close is extremely important because you understand it in a different way, you know, than if you were sitting here looking at news articles.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And then just tell me, how did it come to be that you wound up working in Ron Paul's office? Because, you had all this knowledge about international affairs from firsthand experience, but how did you make that connection?
Well, I was against NATO expansion in the mid-90s when it came around. I was living in Hungary, and I saw what the big defense contractors were doing in Hungary. They came around with fistfuls of dollars, and at the time, they were passing that money around to the former commies. And I didn't and don't like commies or former commies. And they were passing that money around and emboldening people who I thought were bad guys. And I realized that the whole thing was a scam. This is part of the time, Tom, where I was really undergoing my intellectual revolution. I started reading Lou Rockwell, my gateway drug, and Justin Raimondo, my gateway drug, and understanding that it's not just that we're supporting the wrong guys overseas. We shouldn't be supporting any guys overseas. And that's when the light went on. And I completely turned against NATO expansion. I thought it was a terrible idea. And in fact, I went back to Washington in 1999, 2000, to work for a think tank where the head of the think tank was also opposed to NATO expansion. And it was a slight mistake for me because the think tank was not it did not have the ideological bent that I anticipated. And I'll just say that Lou Rockwell and Justin Raimondo were not welcome people there. It was a neocon think tank. And of course, I was fired. But before I went, I went to Ron Paul's office and I talked with Joe Becker, who I did not know. And I just said, I just wanted to let you know that when I was overseas reading what Ron Paul, who I'd never heard of, what Ron Paul was writing about the mess that we created in Yugoslavia, this is the one guy who was a beacon of light, who really understood what was going on. And I just want to tell you to please tell your boss that I really admire this man. And it turns out after I was fired, I got a call from Joe Becker and he wanted to quit because he had to do some other things. He'd been working there for several years and wondered if I was interested in potentially filling that position. And of course, I put my hand over the phone and yelped and screamed it and then calmly answered, oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'll think about that. And that was what year again?
That was 2001. That was just before 9/11.
Oh, wow. So your position became very, very interesting very, very quickly.
Maybe someone should write a Medium article about that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it seems a little suspicious, the timing there, doesn't it? All right. What's going on? I want you to have an opportunity to say something about the Ron Paul Liberty Report.
Well, sadly but happily, with this crazy nonsense in the Middle East, our numbers are going through the roof. We had a record live audience this past week or last week on Iran and on what's going there. We're getting close to 200,000 subscribers and 20 million views. So we're benefiting in a way. But I think it's because, and Tom, you're the greatest example of this too, people are hungry for something that's outside of the quote-unquote mainstream media. They want to have some real news. They want to have some real perspective. And that's what we try to do every day. And we do it on the show. And we've got a big conference coming up in August for the Ron Paul Institute, which the Liberty Report is part of the Institute. And so we reach out to people and we give them alternatives. And, you know, so far it's a free market thing. People are responding and they like it. And as long as they do, we'll keep doing it.
What are the websites you want to tell us about? One or more, I suppose.
Sure. RonPaulInstitute.org is the Institute. And if you want to check out the Liberty Report, it's live every day at noon on the East Coast, noon. And that's just YouTube.com/RonPaulLibertyReport.
All right. Well, I'm going to link to that stuff at tomwoods.com/1433. Send Dr. Paul my regards. It's been a while, but I'm still, you know, I still follow you guys and I'm really glad about your success. And, you know, it's unfortunate that that as you say, you get a spike when things are bad, but when things are bad, that's when we need Ron Paul the most. So, it's working out the way it should. Well, thanks so much for your time. And it's always fun talking to you.
Thanks so much, Tom.
All right, folks, that is it for another week of episodes. I know I have some of you folks, because I know because you email me sometimes, who are budding authors, or they'd like to publish a Kindle book. And that is a great thing to do, by the way. It's a great first product to sell. It's a great way to establish your authority in some area. And it's just a cool thing to do, and it gives you credibility and stuff. But do you really want to master Kindle publishing on your own? I mean, you'd probably commit an atrocity. So I have assembled a free video series, because I've done some Kindle stuff. You know, the old man knows what he's talking about on this. I've assembled a video series, costs you nothing, and that takes you in bite-sized steps through the entire process, plus little-known tactics for publicizing and marketing your Kindle book. So if that interests you, check out the video series at tomwoods.com/Kindle, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.